Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 82, section 5, which is old single column, page 918. All right. We have a couple more sections in this first of the three papers on marriage and family. We'll start up very much kind of in the mode we left off on, where they were giving us some of the basic elements of the dynamics that moved the mores about most specifically marriage. Moved those mores about in the early days of the marriage institution forming and evolving. In the final section in this paper, we get back to one of those sensitive topics that often comes into play when they're talking about the evolutionary phenomenon. As we saw at the beginning of part 3, all of the evolution of life on this planet begins with the mere fact of, or the foundational fact of biologic evolution, genetics. We're most immediately talking about social evolution here when we're talking about marriage and family and the evolutionary phenomenon. But we don't want to ever forget that you're never far removed on a nativity sphere from the facts of genetics. And no matter what subject you're talking about, be it religion or marriage or science or whatever, often the revelators will take a very firm aside and remind us of those issues. And when they do that, it's always challenging to the current politically correct environment that comes out of the 20th century. But before we get to section 6, we've got section 5 here, and let me just say up front about the title, in case those terms which might strike you as kind of technical, if those are mysterious at all to anyone, you've got this issue of that we saw of once you got past the herd sort of a stage, the horde, and you started to form groups like clans and tribes, that obviously brings into play issues of relative to mating. Well, are you mating inside the group or between groups? So that's what we want to deal with here. And so you have endogamy and exogamy. The gamy part there just literally means marriage. Okay. So you can kind of tell by the beginnings of those prefixes, the en is probably coming from what we call in, and that's in, and the ex we all know like exit, meaning out, right? But it isn't just in and out. Because it's not just N and X, right? You have endo and exo. It's within and without. So you have endogamy is marriage within the group, whatever group that is, and exogamy is marriage without the group. So that's this this first issue we want to think about, and we already know that well, there are influences about this that we read about just recently when we finished the Adam and Eve papers. We all know how that started out with Adam and Eve marrying, within the group very much. You know, Adam and Eve's children marrying within the group, mating within the group. We also were, recently reminded about the Noddites and how you could have a pure line Noddite 150,000 years or so after the rebellion with Rada. We shouldn't be surprised if those topics come up here as they discuss that. And how those behaviors of those not purely evolutionary peoples of the Adamites and the Noddites, how that impacted the behavior of the evolutionary peoples, in this regard. Okay, so let's see what they've got for us here.
5, endogamy and exogamy. Very early, the savage observed that race mixture improved the quality of the offspring. It was not that inbreeding was always bad, but that outbreeding was always comparatively better. Therefore, the mores tended to crystallize in restriction of sex relations among near relatives. It was recognized that outbreeding greatly increased the selective opportunity for evolutionary variation and advancement. The outbred individuals were more versatile and had greater ability to survive in a hostile world. The inbreeders, together with their mores, gradually disappeared. This was all a slow development. The savage did not consciously reason about such problems. But later, an advancing peoples did, and they also made the observation that general weakness sometimes resulted from excessive inbreeding.
Okay, so you can, towards the end there, when they say the savage did not consciously reason, remember, in order for someone to reason, you have to have the ability to begin your line of rationalization with a reasonable initial assumption, and that the reasonableness of an initial assumption is assessed with your first cosmic intuition, basic common sense intuition of it's whether it's grounded in fact or not, and whether or not it's a causal thought. It's there superconsciously, and slowly kind of percolates into human behavior in the very, very primitive stages. But then eventually, as they point out, but later in advancing peoples did, consciously reason about such things. They did try to begin to bring a causal, factual assessment into their thinking. The other thing that you notice there, that we've mentioned a few times in this first paper, an awful lot of what we're addressing in this first little survey of the issue in this first paper is not so immediately the full-on social fact of a marriage institution, but the biologic foundation fact of mating and the sex urge that drives it. And so, you see that again. I mean, like I said, the gammy part of the words in the title actually means marriage. But you're talking about inbreeding and outbreeding, right away. So, you see, it's no wonder that the final section is going to very directly address racial genetic issues, because that's the foundation. It's just the mating instinct. Let's see, what else do we have here? The two contrasting things of, even if you aren't in any significant way consciously reflective, experience makes an impression on people. You can learn by leaping. And, you know, even if you aren't very reflective, you, over enough time, you learn by leaping. And so just through long experience, they start to get a little suspicious that maybe there's potential issues with inbreeding. And mores start to bias away from that. And then the more they got into thinking about it consciously, you know, like they said there at the end, they also made the observation that general weakness sometimes resulted from excessive inbreeding. Right? You start to notice, you know, when they say general weakness, you start to think of in a little bit more sweeping, subtle ways. You know, even though this particular instance isn't screaming something definitive to me, I get a sense over many generations and many, many peoples, right? I'm getting a sense of, I think there's a tendency towards weakness here. See, so the more sophisticated the mind gets, the more it can pick up on subtleties. And after all, that's fundamentally what discrimination, which your three insights, your three cosmic intuitions are about, is picking up the subtle differences. The difference that doesn't smack you upside the head experientially, but is really only recognizable with insightful looking, right? And learning by looking, picking up those subtle clues, those subtle biases or tendencies or inclinations in things. Okay. All right, what else do I have to say?
While the inbreeding of good stock sometimes resulted in the upbuilding of strong tribes, the spectacular cases of the bad results of the inbreeding of hereditary defectives more forcibly impressed the mind of man, with the result that the advancing mores increasingly formulated taboos against all marriages among near relatives.
Okay, so let's see how that kind of feeds into what I was just saying. Obviously, very early on, when you don't have a lot of subtlety, it's the spectacular cases of a very negative, recessive offspring that made a strong impression. And we know this is true in general. It's why we get very suspicious about whether or not inanimate objects are really inanimate. Right, because we have a tendency to take stronger note and remember longer when things don't happen in a pleasing fashion than when they do happen in a pleasing fashion. And so we start to believe that, you know, that objects are out to get us, or that, I'm just doomed to bad luck, or, you know, however you rationalize it. Murphy's Laws sorts of ideas about things, you know, that sort of approach. The negative, especially the harsh negative, makes a very lasting impact, and that drives the whole beliefs about chance and luck and those sorts of evolutionary phenomena.
And that's so true. Yeah. The press and everything.
Yes.
All about the negative that everybody gets driven by.
Yes, right, because it, you know, it sells newspapers or gets clicks these days, right? It's the negative that catches us, and like we pointed out, just because we're a little more quote unquote spiritual in general, because of the dawning of the sixth adjutant and the collective in the middle of the 20th century, that doesn't improve that situation. It actually makes it worse. Right? You just use that more general desire for ideals as an error and evil detector in everything that you see and experience. Well, that could have been better, and that could have been better, and you just Before, you were mostly content, and there was just a couple of irksome things. But you get a little bit more quickening of the mind, and then almost every little thing, every little molehill's a mountain, and you're not content in any way, shape, or form. Right? And society just starts to unravel because of it, because everything is not what I expect of Havona, right? To put it in fifth epical parlance. And it's like, okay, that's not news. We don't live in Havona. So you were expecting what? Yeah, not to mention it's the material comfort era. this was in play here, that these spectacular bad results made a huge impression. And so even before you had any sort of subtlety, like they were mentioning at the end of the preceding paragraph of recognition, mores are getting quite definitive about this, that there's only going to be certain exceptions when you have some belief in sort of innate divinity in play, where we're going to let this inbreeding thing be allowed. Okay, so what do we have here?
Religion has long been an effective barrier against outmarriage. Many religious teachings have proscribed marriage outside the faith. Woman has usually favored the practice of in-marriage, man out-marriage. Property has always influenced marriage, and sometimes, in an effort to conserve property within a clan, mores have arisen, compelling women to choose husbands within their father's tribes. Rulings of this sort led to a great multiplication of cousin marriages. Inmating was also practiced in an effort to preserve craft secrets. Skilled workmen sought to keep the knowledge of their craft within the family.
Okay, so, I mean, so at the end of the previous one, taboos against all marriage among near relatives. And they're kind of stressing what we didn't stress there. You're getting these very strong taboos about near relatives, but there's other things in play, other pragmatic issues, like they're just pointing out, where you're not going to get hyper-zealous about this unless religion, quote-unquote, you know, tries to be hyper-zealous about it. But you've got issues of, trade secrets and, like they're saying, and things like that. So you can imagine, like we've said many times, there are bound to be all kinds of variations on the mores. It's going to be a very complex thing. Various groups will go through lots of different stages of mores, and they may eventually end up with something, but then when that group starts mating with another group, their mores aren't the same, and so then you've got complications of blending those mores together, and it's bound to be a very, very hodgepodge, complex phenomenon, as most of these things we've been reading about here, end up being. So you can read various ancient texts and find, quite the grab bag of different modalities.
And they had kissing cousins.
when you think up the cousin thing there, you can tell that immediately there's, it's like, well, okay, so we don't want, close relatives, but see, what's the closest I can get where I can convince myself that it isn't that close, right? The mind starts scheming. We saw this before. As soon as you start getting these more complicated mores, everyone starts scheming on, how you can, fudge around things or get close as possible to fudging around it, and that just adds then to the complexity. Anyone who's had children knows as soon as you set a rule for a little kid, the little kid starts scheming, and comes up with a clever way around this rule. And so it's just the way we are. And it doesn't take a human to do that. Fancy animals, even not so fancy animals, can figure that stuff out. It's like how to get around something. You did, you know, see there at the beginning where you've got many religious teachings have proscribed marriage outside the faith. You know, so like I was saying a second ago, I mean, that can be very, very absolutist and definitive. You know, hear ye, thou shalt not marry, you know, someone who's Catholic if, you know, if because we're Protestant or whatever, right? Now, and then the little interesting thing they throw in there, woman has usually favored the practice of in marriage, man out marriage. They'll continue to kind of unpack that issue as we roll forward. But one of the immediate issues with males, they're going to mention here in just a few paragraphs. So we'll kind of follow that up in a minute here. What's the issue with males and out marriage if it isn't obvious? Let's see here. Anything? Oh, and then again, remember how we if you don't forget that one of the things we just talked about was the preceding section was the property mores. You know, we talked about how significant our seriousness about property helped to guide the evolution of these marriage and family mores. And, you know, as much as that is a problematic thing to think about in a politically correct environment these days, to speak of property, when you're talking about men and women, nonetheless, it was very, very significant in getting things out of that horde, very problematic horde mentality like we talked about. Okay.
Superior groups, when isolated, always reverted to consanguineous mating. The Nodites, for over 150 years, were one of the great in-marriage groups. The later-day marriage mores were tremendously influenced by the traditions of the Violet race, in which, at first, matings were perforce between brother and sister. And brother and sister marriages were common in early Egypt, Syria, Mesopotamia, and throughout the lands once occupied by the Andites. The Egyptians long practiced brother and sister marriages in an effort to keep the royal blood pure, a custom which persisted even longer in Persia. Among the Mesopotamians, before the days of Abraham, cousin marriages were obligatory. Cousins had prior marriage rights to cousins. Abraham himself married his half-sister, but such unions were not allowed under the later mores of the Jews.
Well, let's just start at the end there, since we were talking about cousins a minute ago. Notice how this is kind of along the same lines as what we saw last week when the vicissitudes of the evolutionary process get people... You know, put the notion of virgins. That's an intriguing thing. That idea comes into play, and it doesn't take long, and it kind of takes on a life of its own, where it's not just something you're biased toward for some reason, but it starts to get existentialized. You know, and so you see here too. It's not that you might marry a cousin, you know, then cousin marriages become obligatory. It starts to become this this existentialized thing, cousins had prior marriage rights to cousins. Hands off, boy, I mean, that's my cousin. I get first dibs. So it becomes kind of totally flipped around. And, you know, of course, just like I said up front, sure enough, here's the Nodites and Adam and Eve. You know that's got to come into play with their in-marriage traditions. And, like they said there, it's going to be consanguineous. It's going to be within bloodlines, the literalness of that word. And again, you know, it's like, well, how I have a hard time believing that there could have been a pure line, Nodite 150,000 years later. Well, again, you just have to remind yourself how seriously they took genetics. And the issues of outmating. The original Nodites knew genetics like we can't even imagine knowing genetics yet. Right, so that there was a very, very strong tradition that was established. One can imagine there was probably a lot of a religious element, to it as well as time went by. But nonetheless, they took it very, very seriously, and so you could have a pure line Nodite even 150,000 years later. And then, like I said, more immediately, it was Adam and Eve mating, brother to sister. Adam and Eve's children mating brother to sister. That is so much more recent and has such a historically discernible impact. And we recognize, prior to 6000 B or subsequent to 6000 BC, in recorded history, this phenomenon of brother sister marriage amongst some of those peoples. So, as so many things about Adam and Eve had a very definite impact that is quite apparent in recorded history.
Even Abraham.
Yeah, and then getting even more recent at the end there, Abraham and Sarah, they had the same father, different mother, and so they were half brother, half sister. But again, like they just throw in. Some of these things, the more sophisticated man gets, the quicker some of these mores can evolve. Like they mentioned, but such unions were not allowed under the later mores of the Jews. In other words, you didn't have to go too much further beyond the patriarch days of the Hebrews. And, there were quite significantly different mores. I mean, Moses had a lot to do with, changing the mores of the Hebrews, for instance. But like we mentioned last time, talking about age of consent, that you could, until right at the end of the 19th century, a lot of those mores were relatively unchanged since the mists of time. And then, in relative terms, I mean, overnight, boom, it changes by... from the last two decades of the 19th century to the end of the first two decades of the 20th century, it had completely changed, and you had basically 16, 17, 18 was the age of consent. And we just see that more and more when the revelators talk about you're not in the sheltered bays anymore, you've been pushed out onto the high seas, and there's change, and more change coming in our future, and ever faster change. The more our minds are spiritualized, the quicker we can decide that we want to turn on a dime. And it can become very, very problematic when you radically change the mores, in a time less than a human lifespan. Because you've got all these people, they're facing this direction, and then all of a sudden, that's evil, and 180 degrees is good. And everyone's going, what, huh? Right, it's very discombobulating. The older people are, there's inertia. They don't easily rotate 180 degrees, and all the young ones are born facing the other direction, and look at their elders as completely devoid of any proper nature because of that change in the mores, which means those younger people are going to totally dismiss the genuine wisdom that their elders possess.
Yeah, mores or no mores, I don't think I could ever live with my sisters. Yeah, right. Love dearly, but
Yeah, well, we're getting to that paragraph. yes, but anyway, you know, in my point, you see, notice how this. You see, I was trying to get to, you know, use this to leverage to why is it there's a philosophic emergency? One of the things that's going on is young people no longer look to their elders as sources of wisdom. You go, well, why do they do that? You know, it isn't just that ancient thing, you know, where the kids have, you know, think that their, you know, elders are old fogies. It's part of it is this moray issue that they judge their elders by the fact that they haven't rotated 180 degrees on some little moray issue and throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, they dismiss all of their mind based upon one little element of their mind, which they deem to be evil or utterly inappropriate or whatever, primitive. And so it's very problematic to maintaining civilization when you have a new generation that wants to start from scratch, that wants to dismiss everything that's trying to be handed to them from the previous generation.
That's what our parents said about us. It's like the same thing. So now we're experiencing this on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
From the child side and from the parent side.
Yeah,
it's not easy to keep up with the times all the time.
It is not.
Keep rotating, keep...
Right, and so in some sense, you have to wonder, it's like, well, maybe we should have a more sophisticated society that doesn't expect everyone to keep up with the times. Maybe, you know, and it's like, well, that's, no, you got to have everyone on the same page. Well, okay, guess what? There's a big planet now, and everyone is not on the same page. You know, if you can't respect the people in your own country that are sort of, still functioning in an older moray mode, and they really can't change. How are you going to deal with these people in other countries that are 200,000 years behind you in moray evolution? Are you just going to kill them all because, you know, you find them wanting in their moray system, or what are you going to do? So, it's an important issue that if we're going to be a global people, we've got to figure out how to have an interacting culture that deals with a complexity of mores, and yet not turn nations into multicultural, divided and conquered facts. Right, you have to maintain the integrity of nations, and yet be able to deal with a very diverse bell curve of cultures. So it's a complex problem. All right, let's see now. What else do we have here? We have the way that paragraph started out: the superior groups. All right, we're hinting at where we're going in section six. You know, eventually we need to talk very directly about the contrast between superior and inferior. Let's see, anything else there? I guess we got everything there. Keep going.
The first move away from brother and sister marriages came about under the plural wife mores because the sister wife would arrogantly dominate the other wife or wives. Some tribal mores forbade marriage to a dead brother's widow, but required the living brother to beget children for his departed brother. There is no biologic instinct against any degree of in-marriage. Such restrictions are wholly a matter of taboo.
Okay, I was sort of trying not to say that until we got to that sentence. But you know, that's something I want to stop and emphasize. That's very much in play. This is like the jealousy issue that we've already talked about. What? There's no biologic foundation to jealousy? That's just a socially learned response, huh? Yeah, same thing here. There is no biologic instinct against any degree of in marriage. That's the biologic fact. Remember, we even saw, you know, back here, it was the limitation of marriage to certain age groups that first gave origin to ideas of incest. There is no biologic bias against incest. And initially it was just an issue of, you know, if they had a tribe that had a mori where people separated significantly in age weren't supposed to marry. The fact that they were in your family was not an issue at all. Okay. And it's very difficult for us to even imagine that because we've been so enculturated, it's so ingrained, it seems so biologically founded, but it's not. And the fact that it's not is important to know, not because you're going to say, oh, well, we should eliminate all mores against this. No. You need to understand the challenge when you're trying to institute mores about such things. You can't say, well, the mores don't have to be very definitive. Like, they don't have to be taboos. Because it's all basically biologically instinctive anyway. No, it's not. And you shouldn't be at all surprised if someone doesn't follow the moray because they're just doing what comes naturally. Right? Especially if your culture starts to emphasize that being natural is innately divine. Okay? That's not going to help this problem. The more a group fixates on being natural, don't be surprised if you start having problems with, you know, at least men and young girls. It's natural. Okay? And if we don't understand that, we can't sort of make sure that we're challenging this to be an unnatural phenomenon very definitively up front. And we have to challenge, these things have to be very upfront, very definitive. Because it's not going to happen naturally that it's going to come out the way you want it to. I think everyone can think of very difficult situations that you know about, you know, and during your lifetime along these lines. So there's that very important statement about, you know, that, see, and they say some of these things definitively because they know we're just not going to be able to convince ourselves that there isn't a biologic element to it. So they just tell us some of these things that we can't figure out definitively or conclude definitively on our own. We have to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to govern ourselves wisely. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about how taboo seem to be so archaic, so savvy, so...
Yeah.
And to think that I am subject to taboos is an affront to my my sense of who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but of course, I've already said it several times, you know, we don't use the word taboo, we use a euphemism, politically correct. But it's just as an abomination, you know, if someone violates one of these political correctness tenets. It's taboo. It's a secular taboo instead of a sacred taboo, if you will. And so we have a secular euphemism for it now because, well, taboo, that's a religious word. We don't want to use that word, and that's a primitive religious word at that. Then back to the less prickly issues. if you can call them that, plural wives. And, you know, just some of these basic facts that John was referring to. There are issues when you're close to others, right? And the sister wife would arrogantly dominate the other wife or wives. And so coincidentally, you know, I think these mores are going to evolve where we're not, where I'm not, guys are not going to marry their sisters anymore, because we want plural wives, but it's very complicated to have one of those being your sister. Okay, this is how it rolled. Let's put the sister out of the picture. So it's just very, you know, crude, basic, you know, interplays amongst individuals, like I said, are driving a lot of the evolution of the mores in the early stages.
So there's a difference here between your biologic sister mm-hmm. and your brother and sister in a heavenly.
Right. We're talking about God biologic sisters here, right? Yes. 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 Not the, we're all children of a heavenly father. Yeah, this is not a spiritual issue, no matter how much religion turns it into one subsequently in sort of rationalizing and existentializing the mores. And then you just have to kind of chuckle at that one. So you have a tribal more that forbids you know, marrying a dead brother's widow, but you do have to see to the procreation of his children. remember how we talked about that before? You don't have to have sort of social ideas of marriage and mating completely tightly coupled. Celibacy, you know, doesn't have to be synonymous with chastity, like we were talking about. Right? Celibacy just, you know, technically means you're not married. Just isn't saying anything immediately about sex. Okay, and so you can see that complexity of them not being tightly coupled here. Sex with your dead brother's, you know, widow is not only okay, but obligatory, right? The gods demand it, you know, or, you know, you're going to be condemned if you don't, you know. But no, you can't marry her. Oh, my goodness, no. Okay. You were going to say something?
There reminds me of two things. One is when the scribes try to trip up Jesus with that ridiculous thing where the guy died, you know, and then he had to marry the wife was left over.
Yes.
He died, and then they went through six different marriages. And which one's he going to be married to?
They haven't, yes. Right, yeah. Right.
That was kind of like, you know, similar. It seems like there was still going on at that
particular right, point. Right. See, that some of the things that Jesus was having to deal with, like I said, is, you know, you have all of these complexities of mores and these conflicts between religious notions and ancient mores, and you know, you have books and books filled with rationalization schemes where the Pharisees are trying to rationalize all these complexities.
Didn't the apostles marry, wasn't John married James's widow? I mean, I think so.
Right, yeah, it continues on for the last 2,000 years as you bring the Old Testament into the Christian Bible, you know, and have a Christian Bible that's not just the New Testament, but also has this Old Testament, these Hebrew scriptures, you know, and then Christians, you know, have come up with all kinds of elaborate schemes of rationalizing the diversity of mores presented and all that, and it often gets very tortured to try to, to deal with things like, you know, Lot and his daughters and stuff like that, right? when you're a very straight-laced, you know, Christian, to deal with some of those ancient mores that are, you know, just horrendous in current sensibilities. Huh. But like we're seeing back here, no, it was...
There. Is that the Mormon thing that's not considered?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you can bring in all those issues of polygamy and all, you know, see, all those things, you know, here you have plural wives, I mean, you know, and you not only have, at some point in history, a particular group thinks that plural wives is not only okay, but obligatory, and then subsequently they decide that's an abomination, yeah, but then there's other groups that still think it's okay or even demanded by their God, and, you know, those two groups meet, and this gets very complicated, and, right, I mean, that it's this sort of stuff we're dealing with. And again, like I said last time, one of the important things about the Marriage and Family Papers is to try to challenge us with these very, these issues that we have a lot of feelings about, to challenge us with these issues, to see if we can get ourselves more objective, to lift ourselves up and not be caught up with our peers in these existentialized mores, not dismissive of mores, but able to rise above and think about things in a more objective fashion, so that we aren't just helpless victims of the preachings of the mores system, you know, or the doctrines of our day. You know, be they political doctrines or marriage mores or whatever church doctrines or whatever it might be. Right? If we're going to eventually get to a world enlightened life, everyone has to be able to get above the doctrines of all their religions. And an awful lot of what religion, the doctrines of religions, are related to sex, right? Sex mores and stuff are ensconced in every religion. You have to be able to rise above all that, transcend all of the doctrines of all the religions to get to that one religion that mankind will have way, way in the distant future. Right? You don't just have one of the current religions with the strongest elbows and the biggest weapons that exterminates all the other ones, and that's the one religion in the age of light and life. Right? No, you have to transcend all these things. You know, that this is they're trying to use, the revelators are trying to use these very challenging issues about male female relationships to see if you're ready for the fifth epical revelation. Are you ready to be as objective as they would like you to be to take on this revelation? To face facts. Genuine facts, not the things you call facts, the elements of your doctrines. Right? Can you do that? That's what, you know, they're looking for the people that can do that.
So can you have true monogamy with both endogamy and exogamy?
Yes, I mean, eventually, right, the whole evolution from clan to tribe to nation, right? I mean, you are... I mean, by the time you get to a nation, what every way that you could define something as being out marriage is now inside, right? That is what a nation is. It's bringing all the outside to the inside, you know, in many ways. So,
it's just the evolution.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's where you begin to, you know, differentiate between these issues of mating with close relatives is one thing, you know, but you know, not everyone in your tribe is a close relative. There's a difference there, and the bigger the group gets, the less and less there's any close relatives that you're likely going to stumble upon. But you still might have very definitive ideas that absolutely you cannot mate outside of that group, or you must mate inside of the group, or whatever the ideas might be. So we'll see that. There's this evolution where you begin to leave behind the kind of more biologically based issues, and it starts to take on just more, in many ways, arbitrary social construct things, which you then relate to just as definitively. If you marry anyone outside of this box on the map, you will be executed, right? You know, it's like, well, what difference does it make? I mean, the people on this side of the line and that side of the line are the same. Well, no, it's you absolutely cannot. You know, I mean, we took that definitive sense we had about literal biologic closeness of mating and transferred it to other issues, okay, as we went on. Okay, let's keep going here.
Outmarriage finally dominated because it was favored by the man. To get a wife from the outside ensured greater freedom from in-laws. Familiarity breeds contempt. So, as the element of individual choice began to dominate mating, it became the custom to choose partners from outside the tribe.
Okay, so, like I said, it wasn't too far down the road. There's the biggie. You know, that it's just freedom from in-laws, and familiarity breeds contempt.
That's a real thing.
Yes, if you wondered it, would the Revelators give credence to that old expression of familiarity breeds contempt? Yes, they do. It's right there in black and white. it's an issue. And not to mention, I was waiting till we got to that. You know, if you just think about that thing of that they mentioned that women has usually favored the practice of in-marriage, man-out-marriage. You know, you go, well, why? I mean, it's like, well, it seems like a very foundational statement. It's probably because of a very foundational issue. Do you suppose it has something to do with place and direction? Yeah, obviously, see? Right. I mean, right. The female bias to place is going to favor in-marriage. The male bias to direction is going to favor out-marriage. It's as simple as that. In terms of the initial bias, but as they're pointing out here, as you go forward, there's these kind of more products of experience, that begin to take a greater role. We'll talk about that, and we go from whether or not it's a female-dominated family or a male-dominated family. And how over time it evolved into a male-dominated family, again for reasons like this. It was just that tendency for the female to want everything to kind of just be within a certain circle, and everything just turns around inside that circle of place. It just starts to get too complicated, and familiarity breeds contempt. You know, and at some point you've got to break free from that. We got to get out of here. And the guy is going to be the one that's going to, initiate the getting out of here, mentality. So it just naturally evolves that way.
So let me stop you right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're saying, so it naturally evolves that way. So as we evolve, we become, quote unquote, less natural and more artificial, so to speak. So as we evolve and become more self-mastery, do you think that those kinds of things like that change? Or do they pretty much stay the same for eons and eons?
Think about material sons and daughters on Gerasim and how definitively, they are the pattern for male and female. They're very definitively separated. And they function in a society where they aren't interchangeable parts. They each acknowledges the nature of the other and are content in their roles in an equitable system. An equitable system, not some false equality system. Let's pretend that, there's really isn't any difference for enlightened peoples between a father-led family and a mother-led family. You know, and remember, this goes beyond just some simplistic notion of father-led, mother-led. We'll talk about that when we get to that subject more. The place direction thing just is. And you can't pretend that it isn't and expect to have something that will fundamentally work. You know, I mean, again, why? You know, you say, well, why is a woman placed like? Well, think about it. I mean, one of the two has to actually have the child nurtured inside of her, or him. You know, one of them has to have it inside and give birth to it and nurse it, you know, and immediately care for it. I know, let's make that the very direction-like one. Well, that wouldn't be very smart, would it, for the life carriers to do that? No, I mean, obviously the one that's going to be gestating and giving birth and immediately nurturing that child can't have a biologic tendency to go racing off to the horizon. They need to have a sense of wanting to establish a place, a circle within which they function and keep everything close, because they've got to keep that child close. They've got to keep an eye on that child, or the child dies.
Similar to the mother's spirit in my home, in a way, I guess, in terms of
right.
Wherever she is.
Right, and you know, and in the local universe sense, right? You know, it's a little bit bigger issue there. Than needing to watch over little children so they don't get run over or eaten by a lion or something. You know, someone has to actually take an arbitrary region of space and make it a non-arbitrary region of space. You know, it's not like there's a line of rocks, you know, out there in space, and that's where you can tell when you're inside or outside of the local universe of Nebadon. Because you step across this string of rocks. No, you know you're inside of Nebadon because you're inside of her, and you're outside of Nebadon if you're outside of her. Right? She defines the place. Someone has to define the place. Space doesn't innately divide itself into local universes. Right? The force charge of space has no lines in it, no boundaries in it. Something has to define where a local universe is. It's a very foundational issue at that high level. But again, it's just a downstepped expression when you go to males and females on a nativity sphere. One of them has to be place-like because, you know, one of them is going to have the baby inside of them, right? And that's a place. It's just an inescapable fact. A baby has to be gestating in a place. It has to be that way. And if someone is going to be focused on place, someone has to have their chin up and be looking around. Because, there's a saber-toothed tiger. Let's go this way, right? If everyone is all focused on the kids, they walk right into the lion's den. So it's just innate in the evolutionary process. Let's see here.
That helps me understand a lot. And why I'm walking if I get to
half the garage. Explains a lot. The place direction differential explains a lot. You know, we each needs to recognize that, you know, what they are and what the other is, and not demonize or falsely. Yeah, I mean, it's just the way it is. Okay, it's the way it needs to be. We have to figure out how to deal with that fact. We can't idealistically imagine it away. So you have to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to have a wise relationship with the opposite sex. Yes, familiarity breeds contempt. And notice again, so as the element of individual choice began to dominate mating, there it is again where they're going, well, don't they just mean selection or something? Why do they say choice? And like I said, they're just reminding you as you go forward, especially, there is, at least superconsciously, a choice fact that's casting a shadow down. It's becoming more of a personal phenomenon, even if it doesn't appear to be on the surface. Okay, so they remind you that by using the word choice. Okay, let's keep going.
Many tribes finally forbade marriages within the clan. Others limited mating to certain castes. The taboo against marriage with a woman of one's own totem gave impetus to the custom of stealing women from neighboring tribes. Later on, marriages were regulated more in accordance with territorial residence than with kinship. There were many steps in the evolution of in-marriage into the modern practice of out-marriage. Even after the taboo rested upon in-marriage for the common people, chiefs and kings were permitted to marry those of close kin in order to keep the royal blood concentrated and pure. The mores have usually permitted sovereign rulers certain licenses in sex matters.
Right, I mean, I already alluded to that. And see, the key thing, you know, it's like, well, why did they throw in sovereign there? I mean, what's the point of modifying? I mean, okay, the rulers, why are they emphasizing their sovereign rulers? They're trying to remind you, why do they are they thought of as sovereign? They serve by divine right. There's something innately divine in their nature so that they're not susceptible to the very anciently recognized inbreeding issues. You know, and of course, whenever there was an offspring in a royal lineage that was an unfortunate recessive, you know, you pretended in many various ways that this wasn't a fact because it flew right in the face of your initial assumption about how they're touched by divinity, you know, in some way.
Yeah, we see that today.
Right, yeah, we certainly still see that today. So there's that, and then notice in the middle of the paragraph, it's what I was referring to earlier, John. They're talking about the whole thing of taboo against marriage with a woman of one's own totem gave impetus to the custom of stealing women from neighboring tribes, and then later on, marriages were regulated more in accordance with territorial residence than with kinship. So, like I said, it starts out very definitive with this biologic predicate, but it evolves, and then it becomes a lot more what we would say arbitrary, you know, where literally there's this line of rocks on the ground, you know, that marks a territory, you know, and it's taboo, you know, across that line of rocks, in the same way it was taboo to marry someone closer than your cousin or something. Right, so we, and that's not as unfortunate a development as it might initially seem. Because it's an important part of human evolution that we begin to be able to have a very solid relationship with something that's not immediately tangible, that's more abstract. That's an important, you know, abstract thinking is a predicate to any sort of a sophisticated civilization. Like we talked about when we go from clan to tribe to nation, and then that next step, there's still a territory like there is with a nation, you know, a people of a place, that territorial state, but the state part has these abstractions related to it, like law. You know, law isn't something that you can poke. Now, initially, it kind of had to be. You had to get a big stone and you had to carve it so you could poke it because they couldn't handle the concept of it in just existing abstractly. But more and more, when you're sophisticated, you have to be able to think, you know, and really bind yourself to abstractions, like money.
Like God.
Yeah, or the concept of God, right? I mean, that's a very abstract concept. Yeah, a lot of things.
It's not so abstract if you can set up a stone and call
it. Right, if you can, yeah, make a great big wooden contraption and call it your God, okay, See, initially it had to be tangible, or it just people couldn't relate to it. But it's important, and that's one of the things that's slipping. More and more people at the leading edge of so-called leading edge of civilization just have a very difficult time binding themselves definitively to abstractions. It's like, oh, that's just whatever. That's just an abstraction. I mean, that doesn't rule me in any way. It's like, no, it has to rule you, or we can't be civilized. You can't just because you can't trip over it, you can't, you're not allowed to dismiss it. So, anyway, just to point that out, you're seeing that as part of the evolution. Like I said, they're using the word choice. More and more of a personal nature is creeping in, and initially these abstractions are kind of arbitrary, but, they'll become more real and more consequential as evolution goes along. All right, let's keep going here.
The presence of the later Andite peoples had much to do with increasing the desire of the Sangic races to mate outside their own tribes. But it was not possible for outmating to become prevalent until neighboring groups had learned to live together in relative peace.
Okay, so there we saw something reminded of something we saw earlier when we were talking about the Andites. The Andites were fancy, and a lot of the Sangic tribes thought they were really fancy, and they would do just about anything to see if they could catch the eye of the opposite sex amongst the Andites. That's intriguing. All right, so physical, impressiveness and attractiveness of the Adamites and the subsequent Andites, had a lot to do with helping to get people looking outward more, and obviously, getting that process of going from tribe to nation in play. It's obviously, like they're just about to point out in the next paragraph, that movement from tribe to nation was catalyzed, or we leveraged off of sex a lot to make that happen. Sex and mating and marriage played a huge role in that process of getting people to go beyond the naturalness of tribe to that first step of unnaturalness of a nation. See, a more personal, less mere animal phenomenon of a nation, let alone, like I was just saying, even further on to statehood. Being able to conceive of a state and have that be definitive, and consequential in your life. All right, so
just how vast a conspiracy it really is to think how many factors played into the evolution, the Supreme's plan.
It's why we progress in spite of ourselves. I mean, it's such an airtight conspiracy, right? The whole is upon the parts, right? There is no escape for the parts. The parts inescapably over time move in the direction that the whole needs them to move.
Experience liberation through that instead of outside of it.
Yeah. But the exciting thing is, that you can trust that one way or another, in our ignorance, things will continue to move forward. But the exciting thing is, imagine what it would be like someday when we aren't so ignorant. And we could progress because of ourselves. You know, we had so much of the whole, the cosmos, reflected within us, that we naturally strike step with the big picture, and we don't have to be drugged, kicking and screaming towards our destiny so much anymore. It becomes more and more a conscious choice that we align ourselves with our destiny. We have the patience to put ourselves in a long-term process. And one day the world gets to light and life.
It's fun how relatively near-term fusion is, because it kind of needs to be.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to let things have the opportunity to be that loose for too long.
Yeah. You know, and if they try to stay loose for very long, they don't make it to fusion. They go to iniquity,
yeah.
Right? Right? Because again, like I was just saying, it's an airtight, quote unquote, conspiracy. The whole is right. There is no other way to your destiny except in conformity with the whole. Right? We are not the authors, right, of the framework. Framework just is.
Yeah. But as people become more and more conscious of that, there's a lot of, that's the whole.
Yes, yes. Bobism is the whole, or yes. All right. Right.
It's on sale on Amazon.
Again, that's that adolescent, the difficulty of the adolescent stage. As soon as you start to really reflect on it, I see the way it works. There's parts and then there's a whole. And then go, what is the whole? Bob is very certain that he's found it, and he's very eloquent in presenting it. And I think we should all join Bobism, right? And Bob supplies us through...
Yeah.
Through projection, he supplies us with the whole, right? He takes what's inside of him and projects it outward, and everyone jumps inside the wagon, right?
My favorite
Bob. But again, that's that gets back to what we talk about so much, right? I mean, once you really get a hold of your spiritualized mind, instantly it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, so let's say you do what we often talk about, really, not be just living in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind itself. Let's say you start to really have a conscious resonance with the upper domain. Well, then everything's fine, right? No. Now there's a double-edged sword. Because you're free will sovereign up there. And what's up there isn't necessarily what was put there by grace. That initial reflection of the cosmos, you could have taken a whole bunch of stuff like Bob's notions and drug them in from outside and shoved them up there and replaced the cosmos with Bobism. All right? And so you finally become conscious, this is wonderful. Yeah, but it's not what you think. It isn't the cosmos that you thought you were going to find. You've unwittingly drugged the external world up there and replaced all the cosmic seats with scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma.
That's outside in, right? When you drag that stuff up.
Yeah,
you were talking earlier, and I thought about the inside out thing and the outside in. You said they brought it in, and I don't know how to clear it.
I mean, you got to be a little careful there. I mean, when we talk more precisely about turning yourself inside out or turning the universe outside in, that's the materialism spiritism contrast. That's not precisely what I'm talking about here when I'm talking about just drag, you know, like taking the mores in the external world and bringing them in and putting them up on the fifth level of meaning instead of that initial reflection of the rightness and wrongness, you know, in the genuine cosmos that was put there by grace. Right? I mean, but like I said, I mean, one of the reasons why you might be compelled to take something from the external world and bringing it in and exalt it up, you know, within your mind like that is because I pick on, you know, this imaginary guy named Bob all the time, right? If there's this very clever guy named Bob who has this tendency to turn himself inside out, right, to take what's within him and believe that it really defines the nature of reality in the external world and talks about this very excitedly, I found reality, and what he's really found is himself that he turned inside out. I found reality, join me, you know, and become a part of the reality. A lot of times what we drag up and put in is the fruits of someone turning themselves inside out, you know, and projecting their imperfection and ignorance outward into a cleverly rationalized framework.
What about Bob? Like a Buddha?
I mean, that's the thing you should immediately be thinking of. It's like, well, if it isn't literally Bob, I wonder if it's like Jesus or Muhammad or, right? I mean, these isms. Yeah. And of course, the problem with that Jesusism, it isn't, you know, it's someone's belief about who Jesus was, right, that gets externalized. What the apostles understood about Jesus had issues relative to what Jesus really was and what he was really trying to say. Not to mention going to, you know, Gautama Siddhartha, or Muhammad, or Zoroaster, or Lao Tzu, or Confucius, or, right, anyone else. Yeah. Yeah. Lots of other Bobs that, cleverly constructed a universe that's a projection of their internal rationalization scheme. Okay, let's see. Did we get every? Yeah, we did the sovereign thing. Let's see. Then we did the Andites, right? Okay. Okay, let's go to that next paragraph.
Outmarriage itself was a peace promoter. Marriages between the tribes lessened hostilities. Outmarriage led to tribal coordination into military alliances. It became dominant because it provided increased strength. It was a nation builder. Outmarriage was also greatly favored by increasing trade contacts. Adventure and exploration contributed to the extension of the mating bounds and greatly facilitated the cross-fertilization of racial cultures.
Right. See, so again, you get a little bit more of an Andite nature that's more curious and starts, you know, heading off to the horizons. And then, but there's still that biologic urge thing that... And so things happen. But you see it right there, like I was saying, the nation builder. I think most of us, like especially, you know, this king's son marries this king's daughter, right? And the two tribes come together in a super tribe anyway. And then eventually you get nations. You know, and if it's not kind of coordinated in the leaders like that, like they're pointing out, it's just happening generally. The more transportation and communication improve, the more people stumble upon one another, and what happens naturally happens naturally. You know, you discover that if you hang out with that person that you were told since you were born are innately evil and you should never give any consideration, but you actually hang out with them, it's like, no, actually, I'm hanging out. I'm feeling quite sexually attracted to them. I think we're going to elope. We all know how that works.
Yeah, And then when we get too familiar, we divorce.
Yeah, right. And then familiarity breeds contempt. Yeah. Yeah, which reminds you, see, there needs to be some sort of definitive mores, you know, that, you know, make it so that you don't think, well, I have an easy out. Yep. Yep.
The otherwise inexplicable inconsistencies of the racial marriage mores are largely due to this outmarriage custom with its accompanying wife stealing and buying from foreign tribes, all of which resulted in a compounding of the separate tribal mores. That these taboos respecting in marriage were sociologic, not biologic, is well illustrated by the taboos on kinship marriages, which embraced many degrees of in-law relationships, cases representing no blood relation whatsoever.
So again, just stressing what we're saying up front, that there is no biologic instinct against any degree of in-marriage, like you're saying. I mean, it's just sociologic, as they're stressing there. Because you get all taboo about, you know, well, you absolutely can't marry an in-law. And you're going, well, why not? But again, like I said, you just transfer what's sort of more immediate and biologic to ever more abstract notions. Right, you know, to think about how abstract humans had to get before they could even conceive of something called in-laws. Right, it has the word law in it. Right? Let's see here. Okay, and then the other thing is what I've said many, many, many times, as they're pointing out. It ends up being very, very complicated when all is said and done. The more you mix all these different traditions together, you end up with elaborate hodgepodges of mores, which cause no end of difficulties because people, you know, there's tradition. People have a hard time letting go of stuff. And so, you know, these ancient traditions of the subunits of a nation have a strong tendency to bubble up and pull the nations apart.
Yeah. Probably gave origin to the saying, you're damned if you do and
you're damned if you don't. Yeah. So it's, you know, like I was saying, it's very important that we start to be more objective about these mores. Because we have to deal with a lot of different peoples with a lot of different mores, and we have to not tear ourselves apart as a nation because we just won't let go of the ancient tradition, you know, of our little niche of people from that village in Europe somewhere or whatever. And it's very important that we not be so existential about these things and allow them to just pass away. All right, so now let's get to the more directly these issues of genetics.
6, racial mixtures. There are no pure races in the world today. The early and original evolutionary peoples of color have only 2 representative races persisting in the world, the yellow man and the black man. And even these 2 races are much admixed with the extinct colored peoples. While the so-called white race is predominantly descended from the ancient blue man, it is admixed more or less with all other races, much as is the red man of the Americas.
Yeah, we love that peoples of color expression these days. You know, we should all be reminded. It's like, no, you have no idea. No, I'm talking about literal colors. not white, brown, and black here. I'm talking about red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and indigo. There's people of color. And, of course, when they start out, there are no pure races in the world today. And they speak about these 2 representative races persisting. It's like the yellow man and the black man, not the indigo man. Just, you know, the fact that they call him the black man and not the indigo man is reminding you he's not very pure. Mm-hmm. Right? So how do you get black man? You mix in the other 2 secondary sangics. But you see the point there. You know, you have the very much kind of extinct green and orange. So what do you have left? You know, you don't. You have the indigo man, but let's call him black man because it's not very pure indigo. You have the quote-unquote yellow man. You have that quote-unquote blue man and the white man. And you have the quote-unquote red man in the Americas. Yeah. So, you know, that's their point. It's just of the six sanghiks, you know, that's the degree to which you kind of sort of still have them. But of all, you know, all that aside, I mean, the important thing is just that first sentence. There are no pure races in the world today. I mean, that's a very important sentence in the book in talking about races. So get rid of all of your false sacredness and notions of purity and stuff like that, which lead to racism. Right? There are no pure races. Take all of your spiritual, false spiritual notions out of it, all your ismizing out of it. Okay, purity, that's that spirit word thing, right? That gets us in so much problem. So that's a very important sentence. See, before they say anything challenging about genetics, like using words like inferior and stuff, that's the first sentence. Okay, to try to get you to just think scientifically, pragmatically about this. Not all of your false religiousizing and existentializing about this. Okay.
Of the six colored sanghic races, three were primary and three were secondary. Though the primary races, blue, red, and yellow, were in many respects superior to the three secondary peoples, it should be remembered that these secondary races had many desirable traits which would have considerably enhanced the primary peoples if their better strains could have been absorbed.
Again, if that last statement wasn't the case, secondary sanghics wouldn't exist. I mean, the fact that they exist, it, you know that there's something, you know, let's just say a value, even though we're talking about biology here, you know, it, to them. There's a nature in them that feeds into a mix that leads to an exaltation of biology, which leads to a better relationship to spirit value in that sense. So that's important. Notice the interesting little thing there? Why didn't they say, like, red, yellow, blue? Why did they go blue, red, yellow? Do you notice that? So we've talked about the mind biases of the different sanghics. Think about what they're doing there. So blue, that's individuality. Red, that's unity. And the super additive consequence of associativity, they put them in that order. You know, like matter, spirit, mind. Just a subtle little thing. He's trying to catch you there. Go, why did they put them in that order? Occasionally they'll do that when they're, you know, alluding to the threefold actuality. They'll put them in the super additive order, just to remind you of that fact. So, in that context, it's a little subtle little reminder of the system that is the two sets of three, the sanghics. Yeah, it's not just arbitrary. It's part of a system.
You don't miss a trick, do you? It's just that kind of construct. I probably would have read that 100 times and never even thought about it.
Yeah. See, you can see why. I mean, I brought that out. That's what they're fundamentally trying to do. The truth that's flowing through that paragraph is about how it's a cosmic system, you know, and should be respected as such, engaged as such. You know, there are no throwaway races or something, right? Innately valueless races. Okay?
Present-day prejudice against half-castes, hybrids, and mongrels arises because modern racial crossbreeding is, for the greater part, between grossly inferior strains of the races concerned. You also get unsatisfactory offspring when the degenerate strains of the same race intermarry.
All right. Enough beating around the bush. Let's approach it directly. you know, if you can set your emotions aside and think about this scientifically, you know, what's the difference between hybrid and mongrel, you might ask? The deal with the word mongrel is it has a connotation that the, you know, it's a hybrid, but that the hybrid is, you know, the consequence of more indiscriminate processes.
Like a mutt?
Yeah, like, you know, when you talk about mongrels with mutts, right? I mean, just arbitrarily two dogs, you know, mate. No one is sort of over-controlling the mating. I mean, that's the idea, you know, that's the connotation with the word mongrel relative to hybrid. You know, hybrid, you know, sounds much more like someone is, you know, is thinking about the facts and the causality, using their first cosmic intuition and can over-controlling this, you know, this interbreeding. You know, but we all know in this false religiousizing of this, the difference in hybrid and mongrel is lost upon most those people, and it's all just evil, right? Any sort of crossbreeding. But the points are, like they're saying, that you have this unfortunate fact that because of various moray issues, it's the grossly inferior strains that have long had a tendency to mate anyway, right? Because they won't submit themselves to some sort of definitive cultural bias that, you know, so they don't do it. Now, so, you know, so you end up with this, this kind of inescapable bias to the consequences because of the predicates to this mating. It's the grossly inferior strains that have tended to do this and have produced this negativity about half-caste hybrids and mongrels. But then, of course, they remind you, yeah, but you also get unsatisfactory offspring with the degenerate strains of in the same race. It's fundamentally not about race. In the previous paragraph, like I was saying, the races in and of themselves are valueful elements of a cosmic system. But you have this inescapable issue that we aren't created as supreme expressions of finiteness. There's imperfection in our nature. Now, all the way to literally degenerate, you know, which is that vertical word, very much of the vertical word. You know, and all races start out with an innate tendency over time to produce degenerate strains on every world. It's not just because of decimal world and default and all those issues, right? It's innate in our finite, imperfect, incomplete beginning. And so Adam and Eve deal with those issues, right? And see to it that those degenerate strains don't endlessly propagate forward into the future.
We're all aware of the pressures of evolution would tend to eliminate these inferior strains, but it obviously hasn't eliminated.
Well, and the more cushy culture becomes, you know, the more the lesser strains can continue on. When you have a very harsh, hostile environment, you know, if you can't, if you're very debilitated, you know, you'll die in the next battle. Right? But, you know, now we can be, yeah, very limited, and we're coddled and allowed to procreate, and we carry forward into the future. Yeah, so these are very harsh things, you know, but these are the facts. Okay, keep going.
If the present-day races of Urantia could be freed from the curse of their lowest strata of deteriorated, antisocial, feeble-minded, and outcast specimens, there would be little objection to a limited race amalgamation. And if such racial mixtures could take place between the highest types of the several races, still less objection could be offered.
Okay, so they started you out kind of gently with degenerate. It's like, okay, I can nod my head up and down to that. Yeah, degenerate, especially when Chris emphasizes vertical. Okay, but look what they do. In the next breath, they give you the full spectrum. Deteriorated, antisocial. Remember, we've talked about that before. Feeble-minded and even outcast specimens. It just reminds you of, it starts out, you know, you have to start out with the low-hanging fruit, as it were, okay? But you don't get, you know, into light and life until there aren't, you know, anyone anymore genetically that is even remotely something that's going to be antisocial. You know, like I've said many times to emphasize this, there isn't a single person alive on the planet, including, we could go back 2,000 years ago and take Jesus, put him in the mix too. There isn't a single person, right, that would be allowed to procreate on any world in light and life. There isn't a one of us that are even remotely genetically valid enough, including Jesus himself, to be allowed to procreate on a world in light and life. Right? I mean, his tendencies that he got from his mom and stuff like that, that's an abomination on a world in light and life. No one like that is, you know, alive. Right? And they're still, you know, it's in the stages of light and life, they're weeding out things that we can't even imagine you'd ever want to weed out, you know? They're going, well, that's a lesser person. You're thinking, no, that's a person that's 100,000 times more magnificent than Jesus. What do you mean that's a lesser person? I mean, we can't even imagine, right? Just how fine a detail they're down into and going, oh, that's a little limited.
What about Adams?
I mean, again,
different.
Well, not totally, because again, like I've said many times, I mean, sure, Adam and Eve come, they do this biologic uplift, there's all this great genetics, but that their genetics doesn't get a world of light and life. Genetic engineering gets a world of light and life. Right?
They're behind that.
I mean, see.
So they have to be compatible with what they find here.
Right. You know, the offspring of Adam and Eve, if not Adam and Eve themselves, are downstepped, right, to match up. All right, so, you know, even with the full biologic uplift, there's all that genetic engineering that has to occur on every world to get it to the stage of worlds in light and life genetically.
So is that, yeah, because it's going toward perfectness?
Right, because everything is just moving to the grand universe being perfect, yeah, perfected. And that's a long, long process. And it all has a biologic predicate, like we've been saying. Right? It's not like when you're in this fifth stage of light and life, there isn't a biologic predicate anymore. And everyone are just blobs of glowing spirit stuff. No, they're made out of this stuff. Okay? I mean, how fancy does my matter have to be for my mind to attune to it and be able to consciousize the super universe tongue? Yeah. a lot fancier than this blob of protoplasm, I can tell you that.
We would be hermetically sealed.
Like I've said, okay. Not only would they not allow you to procreate, they wouldn't allow you to interact with the environment,
yeah.
Breathe the air. you would be put in a hermetically sealed bottle. Okay.
So let me ask you, we as people, you know, we live our evolutionary world experience here on this world, you know, which is way backward. Do you think we'll ever see what a world of light and life looks like?
I mean, when you start taking field trips in your ascension career, yeah, you'll get to see them. I mean, you won't have to go far. I mean, think about some of the first worlds in this local system that have been around for hundreds of billions. Yeah, they're deep, deep in light and life. They're not that far away.
Is there a level to be able to visit there even?
Or a Marantia being be able to...
Yeah, right. You go there as a Marantia being on a field trip and...
Still won't be very involved as a
project. Yeah, you can either watch the incredible humans there, or you go to some other world and where there aren't humans yet, and you can watch the dinosaurs or whatever, right?
Okay.
but I mean, a lot of that is tied to, your progress. I mean, you couldn't relate to a lot of things on that world until you'd gotten up in your ascension career to a certain degree, right?
Okay. Got a long ways to go.
Yep. Okay, let's keep going here.
Hybridization of superior and dissimilar stocks is the secret of the creation of new and more vigorous strains. And this is true of plants, animals, and the human species. Hybridization augments vigor and increases fertility. Race mixtures of the average or superior strata of various peoples greatly increase creative potential, as is shown in the present population of the United States of North America. When such matings take place between the lower or inferior strata, creativity is diminished, as is shown by the present-day peoples of southern India.
Okay, notice how they italicize creative potential. So here, I was already alluding to this. This is not merely a biology unto itself issue. Right? Your biology is your foundation for your relationship to spirit. Creative, right, is not inventive or clever, right, or whatever. No, it's creative. That's what your personalized self of spiritualized mind can do. And if the genetics is lowly, in many ways you're sort of effectively bounded away from your human nature. Don't have access to it. It's all just inescapably superconscious. It's never going to really become a conscious phenomenon that then manifests into the civilization around you. Okay. Well, that's what they're trying to emphasize. This isn't that these biologic issues are important because they're a foundation for something higher. And when you've got people today that don't even believe in mind, let alone spirit, are philosophic materialists. No wonder that they might become very, very biased away from. Talking like this paragraph talks, talking about, and this is true of plants, animals, and the human species. Those things that at the beginning of the 20th century, stemming from Darwin's thoughts and stuff in the 19th century, humans were starting to talk about, and now are verboten, as I always say, or forbidden. It's not just because of the excesses of the Nazis, right? In some ways, it's forbidden because it's believed to be utterly devoid of reality, because we're just collections of molecules, and so discussions of higher and lower are literally of no reality, Right? All the matter is in a plane. Right? And so any notion, you know, that there's some verticalness, which there is because of mind above matter and spirit above mind. You see, if you reject mind and spirit, right, then there can't be any verticalness. And it has to be just false verticality that, you know, where people are trying to oppress or whatever others, right?
You'd be surprised how many people don't even know what mind is.
Right.
It's not even spring.
Yeah.
But, oppression is, what did you say? Oppression is some kind
Well, you know, if you're going to try to oppress someone, you know, you're saying, and there's a falseness to it. You just arbitrarily say, well, I'm above you, and therefore I have a right to keep you down. You know, but if you reject the vertical dimension, you know, you reject anyone's validity in saying that they're above you and have a right to rule over you. But of course, you know, it's inescapable. We do have minds, and brilliant intellects start to think of themselves as having a divine right to rule over lesser intellects, like for the mode we're getting into these days. We don't have divine right of kings anymore, but we are getting, you know, the equivalent, with innately brilliant people thinking they have a divine right to rule over the common man because they're smarter.
I thought it was because they're better actors. Let's go to this thing in India. This is 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, right now the Silicon Valley of India is in southern India because of things that certain things have changed in that particular area. Maybe they're talking about something different.
Well, I mean, they're just talking about, you know, remember we talked about that with when we talked about India. Just the fact that the andite infusion into India definitely is most in the north.
Okay.
Right? And the degree to which you might have better genetics farther down in to the south. Remember they talked about that. A lot of those people in the south were driven to the east, and that's why you have issues in the eastern regions of India, like Calcutta and over into Bangladesh. Okay, like we've pointed out. Now, where was Mother Teresa? Let me think. Where did she find genetic issues? Right, where those lesser peoples they're talking about there, ended up. Now the other thing though, don't forget that's why they italicize creative. People can have, in a spiritual sense, lesser genetics, like we're talking about here. But they still can do very fancy material tasks. I can teach a minor bird to say English words. So there's a difference between being able to train someone to do routine material tasks in a factory and them being someone who's genuinely creative and can self-initiate civilization. Okay.
Race blending greatly contributes to the sudden appearance of new characteristics, and if such hybridization is the union of superior strains, then these new characteristics will also be superior traits.
There you have the super additive consequence, why they're italicizing the new there, because it's not additive, it's super additive, so it's new. They're putting in the superior, they're kind of leading into the next paragraph here. So let me just hold off and let's read the next paragraph before I comment further.
As long as present-day races are so overloaded with inferior and degenerate strains, race intermingling on a large scale would be most detrimental. But most of the objections to such experiments rest on social and cultural prejudices rather than on biologic considerations. Even among inferior stocks, hybrids often are an improvement on their ancestors. Hybridization makes for species improvement because of the role of the dominant genes. Racial intermixture increases the likelihood of a large number of the desirable dominants being present in the hybrid.
So they're, you know, they're italicizing a bit about dominant genes because they're reminding you how the life carriers have set this up. So you know, you have all these different races, and there's primaries and secondaries. There's this vertical phenomenon, but they set it up with the dominant genes so that when you blend things together, as long as Adam and Eve and others are over-controlling issues with degeneracy and stuff, you get the best of all of them in the final product. Okay, and they all have dominant things to contribute. Okay, something in a secondary sanguine will be dominant over something in a primary sanguine because it's what needs to end up, you know, in the final mix. And so they're just hinting at the sort of the science of how they've set this up so that it can sort of naturally produce the proper blending that you're looking for, in you know, to get the positive super additive consequences of the relationship between, say, the orange race and the blue race, or whatever. Let's see, and what else we have there? Just notice how they're using, you know, even among inferior stocks, hybrids often are an improvement on their ancestors by saying hybrids instead of mongrels. That's what I was reminding you. I mean, someone's over-controlling. This isn't just a you know, haphazard phenomenon that they're talking about there. Because yeah. Like they said way up there, it's the haphazard thing that leads to lots of problems when you're dealing with the inferior stocks. Okay.
For the past 100 years, more racial hybridization has been taking place on Urantia than has occurred in thousands of years. The danger of gross disharmonies as a result of crossbreeding of human stocks has been greatly exaggerated. The chief troubles of half-breeds are due to social prejudices.
So they, you know, they mentioned that above. You know, objections to such experiments rest on social and cultural prejudices rather than on biologic considerations. And I'm just stressing that again. And that gets back to what I was saying a while back. A lot of the stuff that we read in the marriage and family papers is trying to help us to be able to get above all of our notions and our intense beliefs about these notions and be able to relate to things more objectively from the top down so that we aren't being governed by preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. You know, you see them mentioning social prejudices there. That you know, so much of what we you know, even our science now is being ruled by preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, not to mention our crossbreeding. Okay? So we have to get out of these old natural moray taboo and ignorance and whatnot modes about things.
So how do we do this? I mean, you know, we sit here as a small number of people and read this in Revelation, and we can sit there and you can sit there and say, this is what we need to do. But, you
know, it starts with
the majority of the world.
Sure.
Is not there.
But again, it starts with each of us as individuals.
So you know, is it basic little by little?
Little by little. That's the way evolution works. Because again, the world's not going to be transformed by fiat. That's the problem with thinking, if only so-and-so would come and he'd wave his magic wand and change the world by fiat. It's not going to happen. He would be in rebellion if he did that. Even if, you know, even if it's a master son, it literally kind of has a magic wand, as it were, you know, and could change things. It's an evolutionary process. It happens little by little. They would just guide that.
Right, so that process is basically an educational process.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, I start with myself, and I work on my preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, and then as I raise my children, I don't, you know, bestow my prejudices on them, and et cetera, et cetera.
Or I talk to talk to my friends or stuff like that.
Right. But yeah. I mean, even if you don't try to change the way your friends think, your acquaintances think, you just don't talk in that mode that fosters the perpetuation of such things. Right? And you can, you know, you can do that subtly, without being preachy, or being obvious. He's obviously not saying certain words. You have to be clever about this.
Eventually scholars get into it, and eventually professors start teaching, and things like that start to happen.
Right, but it has to happen organically, and it starts with a few individuals. Yep.
Well, that's how I came to this group, because I knew John Stevens. We met regularly,
mm-hmm.
and he started thinking differently.
Yeah.
And
you were curious about why he was thinking differently.
Why he's not thinking the same way he used to think. So I came to find out, because obviously nothing positive could be found in Boulder.
So why bother even come here?
It's all prejudice. And preconceived opinions about Boulder.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was Nazareth.
It's a very similar thing. something about familiarity breeds contempt or something like that. Okay, keep going here.
The Pitcairn experiment of blending the white and Polynesian races turned out fairly well because the white men and the Polynesian women were of fairly good racial strains. Interbreeding between the highest types of the white, red, and yellow races would immediately bring into existence many new and biologically effective characteristics. These three peoples belong to the primary sangic races. Mixtures of the white and black races are not so desirable in their immediate results. Neither are such mulatto offspring so objectionable as social and racial prejudice would seek to make them appear. Physically, such white-black hybrids are excellent specimens of humanity, notwithstanding their slight inferiority in some other respects.
Okay, so does everyone know what the quote-unquote Pitcairn experiment is? That's the mutiny on the Bounty. Some of the mutineers, along with the Tahitians that were on board with them, ended up on Pitcairn Island, and what happens naturally happened naturally.
It was planned. It
was an experiment by the Supreme, but not an experiment by the mutineers. They were just doing what comes naturally. Little did they know there was a vast conspiracy afoot that was his. Coincidentally, you're going to mutiny, and you're going to find yourself on this remote island, and you're going to be left alone for a long time. And yeah.
You think you're not in the sea anymore?
Yeah. Try to escape the experiment is the evolutionary process. The other thing there is notice the way they, in that final sentence, physically such white-black hybrids. Why is it white hyphen black and not black hyphen white in that particular context? Because it starts with the word physically. Right, indigo man, right, is biased to the first adjutant, right, the foundation of the flesh. Right, so they're put in the foundational element of the hyphenated word there. Yeah. They're excellent specimens of humanity, right? I mean, so you get that individual that's very firmly grounded because of the indigo man and the black man, and then you put a little bit of augmentation upon that foundation, and you can get something quite significant in a number of ways. Okay, it may not be able to work way up in the high levels of abstraction, but it'll be a very solid grounded fact if it's well nurtured. Right? Yeah, nature isn't everything, right? Nurture still plays a big role here. Oh, and, you know, the fact that we're talking about when they set up their plants, animals, and the human species, you know, ever thought about the word mulatto? Starts with M-U-L. Gee, if you put an E after that, you'd have a hybrid between a horse and a donkey. Yeah, that's exactly where the word comes from. Oh, yeah. All right, mule. Yes.
Where's my safe
space? Yes, where's your safe space? Yes, not for those timid souls. Yeah, when you read this section, especially if you think about carefully about the section. Okay.
When a primary sangic race amalgamates with a secondary sangic race, the latter is considerably improved at the expense of the former. And on a small scale, extending over long periods of time, there can be little serious objection to such a sacrificial contribution by the primary races to the betterment of the secondary groups. Biologically considered, the secondary sangics were in some respects superior to the primary races.
So just kind of between the lines there, so you're thinking about how this, when you have a world like ours that has secondary sangics, so the way this would, you know, would have normally worked is you blend the primaries and the secondaries and you produce a hybrid that in some ways is pulled down, weighted down by some aspects of the secondaries, but don't judge it by its actuality. Judge it by its potentiality. Yeah, in actuality, you seem to have lost something, but in potentiality, the real nature, you've gained something. There's a potential now in that apparently lower actuality that you can't get into play any other way, so that when you bring in Adam and Eve and uplift the whole thing and actualize those latent potentials, right, you get something that lifts up higher in some respects than a world where you only have primaries. Right? So sometimes you've got to, you know, apparently lower things a little bit in order to achieve a greater end result. You know, these processes are complicated. We kind of saw that in the circuitous ways of the biologic evolution to get up to humans. It's like, it's going off in this curious tangent. Remember, we often kind of visualize it. It's got to wander around horizontally until finally it can find the place where it can go up vertically. Right, it's a very complicated process. So you can kind of see the way it's supposed to work. You have diminishing results in the short term so that you can have greater results in the long term.
The way they word this, though, they're cautioning us against the whole scale.
Yes.
Wholesale.
Right.
Of the races.
And we know why they're cautioning against that wholesale, because they mentioned that earlier. The problem is that all of the degenerate, you know, and similar stocks that are, you know, this is what makes it so you just can't do it, you know, in any sort of universal fashion. We need some serious, insightful management of this process. And that's why some of the revelators sure hope that Mach Aventis doesn't just assume planetary prince, but takes on that biologic oversight role and will, in the not-too-distant future, start to give us some guidance about these issues. You know, not only who, you know, what's the best way to think about intermating, but you know, maybe also helping us with overcoming all that problematic, all the problems with that sort of natural process, and let's just get right to the genetic engineering here. You know, maybe we just need to seriously start re-engineering mankind in this kind of earlier stage of our evolution. To deal with the limitations of our biologic nature.
It's too late for us. For the future. But this is kind of seems to me a little bit of this, when you said this thing, sort of like the least she'll be the greatest and the last should be first in a way. It just sort of shows you how love, you know, how lovingly and mysteriously, you know, sometimes it all works out, and then how it all works out, you know, for the in a positive way. I mean, it's really reassuring.
Yeah, I mean, just with that, when they're talking about the white hyphen black hybrid, and we were fleshing that out. It's a way you can kind of visualize this. Think about how important it is for an athlete that's going to jump, you know, like a high jump or, you know, pole vaulter or whatever, to have a very well planted, launch point in order to achieve the best results in terms of their lift. You know, if you have secondary sangics, you can get the races to get a very definitive foundation and then bounce off, if you will, that firm foundation, rather than kind of being floating up and not being able to really plant their feet well and hence jump very high.
You're talking figuratively as well.
Yeah, I'm just kind of playing that off, see, how you can visualize the nature of the genetic phenomenon with that physical analogy of someone who has to plant their feet well in order to achieve, you know, a significant high jump, right? If they're sliding horizontally, right, they're not going to jump very high. There has to be a good... So that's a way you can visualize what I was saying about the secondary sangics, you know, eventually allowing heights that the primaries under themselves can't achieve. Okay. All right, and then final little bit here.
After all, the real jeopardy of the human species is to be found in the unrestrained multiplication of the inferior and degenerate strains of the various civilized peoples, rather than in any supposed danger of their racial interbreeding. Presented by the Chief of Seraphim stationed on Urantia.
Right, so that final paragraph is, you know, the bottom line that Gene was pointing out. See, when all is said and done, with all the facts... You know, that's what they want to leave you with. It's not fundamentally a racial issue. It's a degeneracy issue. In a primary way, it's a degeneracy issue, and then in a secondary way, it's the other aspects of inferiority. And you notice it's in that inferior and degenerate. See, like I was saying, the primary foundational thing is that vertical degeneracy issue, totally independent of any racial predicate you have. Okay, and then the final little thing, just quickly before we end. So here we are, we're reading about marriage and family and all this stuff, and go, what? Presented by the Chief of Seraphim stationed on Urantia? Why? You know, and don't forget, that's not a seraphim. What's that? What is that Chief of Seraphim in our world? No, it's a primary supernaphim. Right? The highest of the angels. Why on earth would, you know, not only this, but all three of the marriage and family papers be authored by this primary supernaphim, Chief of Seraphim on our planet? Well, the first thing that you kind of guess at between the lines is like, well, he's Chief of Seraphim. Set aside the fact that he's a primary supernaphim for the moment, but he's Chief of Seraphim. That must indicate that the seraphim have probably a lot to do with guiding marriage and family.
And race.
Right, and race and lots of things, right? You know, and just, you know, one little point that you can bring into play more precisely about that. You know, that primary supernaphim, you know, up there in the seraphic planetary government paper, you know, says that as planetary chief of seraphim, I preside over this council of seraphic chiefs. Remember, there's 12 chiefs in a council of the 12 groups of master seraphim. You know, and he presides over that council. Well, yeah, I'll explain that in a second. And you go, well, okay, so there's some specific seraphim. I wonder if there's any of them that have something to do with marriage and family. Ah, yes, number 9, the home seraphim. And your angel now enjoys the services of the 5th group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. So if for no other reason, you can appreciate the validity of this individual being an author because of the home seraphim. Right, we're talking about their domain, what they foster, what they uphold. And the he-she thing, in a highest sense, you can call all angels she, because a primary superniphim is the offspring of the infinite mother spirit. So in that sense, it's a she. But when you're talking about a she that's so transcendent like that and their offspring, relative to the seraphim of a local universe mother, she, and those being daughters, someone that transcendent kind of has more of a he-like.
Hails from where?
I mean, literally from the Isle of Paradise. The primary superniphim is literally the offspring of the third person. Okay. And mostly are just on the Isle of Paradise. Except for exceptions like this. Right. Very high being. See, very transcendent, very he-like, in relative terms to us. So, technically you could say she... But it can help to just, they're not going to relate to you as she-like as a local universe seraphim does. They're going to be a little bit more distant, if you will, a little bit more transcendent and he-like in the way they relate. That's why it's important that the primary superniphim has an actual seraphim tested by the rebellion that's as a deputy. You may remember there, they talk about that deputy. Okay, anyway. So they know wherever they speak, yes. Okay, so like I said, so next time now we'll actually get more definitively into the marriage institution, its evolution, little less emphasis on the biologic predicate to the phenomenon, a little bit more about it directly as a cultural fact. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.